So let us read on in Ecclesiastes, and I want to pick up in verse 9. We've already read this probably a couple times, but I want to begin with verse 9 of chapter 3 and read to the end of chapter 4. And we'll make a serious attempt to get to the end of chapter 4 in preparation for 5, chapter 5 in the next time, and we'll see if we can do it. Anybody in here a betting man? Do you think I can cover the territory that I've predicted? If you're a betting man, then you would take all the odds against me. And you would probably be a rich person if you bet enough money on that. Verse 9, what profit has the worker from that in which he labors? And I would like to say in reading this verse, it looks as though Koheleth is shifting gears here, and in a way he's always shifting gears in this letter. It seems like he's dropping down into the gear you hadn't expect him to drop into, or moving up into a gear sometimes, or turning a corner that was unexpected. But in a larger sense, he's dealing with that one issue, and that is he's establishing in sort of a haphazard fashion his thesis in the very first couple of verses, and that is all is vanity. And he's building that case now, piece by piece, and sort of what appears to be unrelated part of the puzzle to unrelated part of the puzzle. But there is kind of a string that flows through here. It's that theme of vanity that flows through the entire treatise. But there's also connectors here that sometimes don't seem to be real obvious. And one of the connectors here, again, he's repeating himself. And in verse 9, he's reacting to the first 8 verses. There's a time for all these things, and they're all purposes under heaven, and they're all seasons in the flow of time. And he's asking again the same thing he asked in the first chapter, but for a different reason, and that is, why all this work? Why are we as humans, as individuals, just giving ourselves, given the seasons and the fact that we are caught, as it were, in the ebb and flow of time, out of our control, out of our direction and largely, and out of our ability to affect it? What profit is there at all from a worker who just labors his entire life and now is going to be subject, as he has all his life, to the ebb and flow of time? In fact, he says in chapter 9, I think, that time and chance happen to everybody, and so the race is not to the swift and the battle's not to the strong. He says, but time and chance happen to them all. So in a sense, he's shrugging his shoulders again and throwing his hands up and saying, what's the profit? So that's verse 9, very much connected to the first 8 verses of this chapter. Then Solomon shifts and he says in verse 10, I have seen the God-given task with which the sons of men are to be occupied. He has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has put eternity in their hearts, except that no one can find out the work that God does from the beginning to the end. I know that nothing is better for them than to rejoice and to do good in their lives, and also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor. It is the gift of God. I know that whatever God does, it shall be forever. Nothing can be added to it, and nothing taken from it. God does it that men should fear before him. That which is has already been, and that is, and what is to be has already been. And God requires an account of what is past. Moreover, I saw under the sun, in the place of judgment, wickedness was there, and in the place of righteousness, iniquity was there. I said in my heart, God shall judge the righteous and the wicked, for there is a time there for every purpose and for every work. I said in my heart, concerning the condition of the sons of men, God tests them, that they may see that they themselves are like animals. For what happens to the sons of men also happens to animals. One thing befalls them. As one dies, so dies the other. Surely they all have one breath. Man has no advantage over animals, for all is vanity. All go to one place. All are from the dust, and all return to the dust. Who knows the spirit of the sons of men, which goes upward, and the spirit of the animal, which goes down to the earth? We might rephrase that. Who knows whether the one goes up and the one goes down? So, verse 22, I perceive that nothing is better than that a man should rejoice in his own works, for that is his heritage. For who can bring him to see what will happen after him? Then I returned and considered all the oppression that is done under the sun. And look, the tears of the oppressed, but they have no comforter. On the side of their oppressors there is power, but they have no comforter. Therefore, I praise the dead who are already dead more than the living who are still alive. Yet better than both is he who has never existed, who has not seen the evil work that is done under the sun. Again, I saw that for all toil and every skillful work, a man is envied by his neighbor. This also is vanity and grasping for the wind. The fool folds his hands and consumes his own flesh. Better a handful with quietness than both hands full together with toil and grasping for the wind. And then I returned, and I saw vanity under the sun. There is one alone without companion. He has neither son nor brother. Yet there is no end to all his labors, nor is his eye satisfied with riches. But he never asks, for whom do I toll and deprive myself of good? This also is vanity and a grave misfortune. Two are better than one, because they have a good reward for their labor. For if they fall, one will lift up his companion. But woe to him who is alone when he falls, for he has no one to help him up. Again, if two lie down together, they will keep warm. But how can one be warm alone? Though one may be overpowered by another, two can withstand him, and a threefold cord is not quickly broken. Better a poor and wise youth than an old and foolish king who will be admonished no more. For he comes out of prison to be king, although he was born poor in his kingdom. And I saw all the living who walk under the sun. They were with the second youth who stands in his place. There was no end of all the people over whom he was made king, yet those who come afterward will not rejoice in him. Surely, this also is vanity and grasping for the wind. Now, chapter 5, Solomon moves into what appears again to be different territory. But those of you who are familiar with Ecclesiastes know that all through these chapters, he is going to revisit from different angles, sometimes exactly dead on as he did before, the same themes and topics throughout the remainder of this treatise. And so chapter 5 will tie nicely together with things that he's already said and things that will come after. Now, I did mention to you, and just by way of sort of a, I don't know, revisitation or a recapitulation, that in chapter 3, verse 1, Solomon has laid out the ebb and flow of time, and specifically he has tied the experiences of our lives in all these categories, these 14 couplets that he lays out for us, which are summary in fashion, not exhaustive in their content, but he lays out in these couplets the movement of things under the sun, but also the intention of things under heaven. And so he says to us, there's a season and a time for every purpose under heaven, and that is the movement of time, its inception, its conclusion, and everything that moves in and out seasonally in time is heaven ordained. That is hard it is a sharp-edged piece of theology that is hard for us and that we often get cut on and bleed. And all you have to do is read those 14 couplets and extrapolate them out in your own experience. And he's going to do that for us in chapter, the end of chapter 3 and chapter 4 and the rest of this treatise. He's going to take those categories and he's going to give us teased out illustrations of that. And so one of the first things that he does, for instance, in chapter 4, is he talks about the oppressed. And you have to ask yourself, who are the oppressed and what kind of oppression do they suffer? And he's being very general in his dealing with the oppressed. But Israel, in her prophetic books, and God speaking through the prophets, often raised up the cause of the oppressed, the widow and the fatherless and others who were suffering under injustice. And that's what he's talking about here. And it is a bitter thing to be on the wrong side of power exercised unjustly and unjustly. And I don't know how much we know about that. And I don't know how much we specifically, in the socioeconomic segment that you and I exist in, that we probably don't think very much about, I don't know if we have a way to identify with what's being said here. But there are large swaths of the earth's inhabitants who suffer under unmitigated and unrequited oppression. And they have nobody to take up their cause. They are under the absolute thumb of those who are in power and who are absolutely taken in their power and the expression of it. Israel knew this in her own history because she was variously and often subjected to powers more powerful than she, and in the end was actually dragged kicking and screaming and bloody and beaten into captivity by a power stronger than she. But you look at that and you think, how sharp-edged is this disposition of time, and how is it that heaven can be ordaining the rhythm of time and God be in all of that when it is so hard-edged and so sharp and so difficult in the experience? Theologically, we can make songs out of the first 8 verses, right? You guys know what I'm talking about? The Birds. How many of you remember that group? And yeah, see, you're going to be in a certain segment if you're going to raise your hand there. Either that or the song's going to have gone all the way through a generation and start to pop back up as being cool in the next generation. But the Birds, formerly the Yardbirds, I remember watching them on the Ed Sullivan Show. How many of you remember the Ed Sullivan Show? Yeah? See, nobody, or a couple in here. We've had a really, really big show tonight, you know. You could probably watch that on YouTube or something if you wanted to. But the Birds made these 8 verses, or these 7 verses, a popular song. To everything there is a season, turn, turn, turn. And they sing through this whole thing. But the reality is much worse and much more hard-edged than the entertainment of a song. Life in all of its expressions here can be quite painful and quite bewildering. But in the rhythm of our lives, and this is what this is a rhythm of season, in the rhythms of our lives or in the rhythm of the existence of mankind, heaven, in all of these ways and in all of these things, always or often undiscoverable by us, is still working out its purposes. Heaven is working out its purposes. And so, just a few side pointers to you before we move on to the last part of chapter 3 of how to think and how to respond to the rhythm of time, because you're caught in it, right? You know that? In fact, in chapter 3, verse 18, Solomon is going to say, "Now I said in my heart concerning the condition of the sons of men." What do you think he means by that phrase? What is the condition of the sons of men? He's describing it for us. What is our condition? Just kind of mull that over in your head a little bit. But in this condition of the sons of men, in which Solomon says God tests men, or he lays them open, so to speak, he exposes them, what are we to think and how are we to respond to all this? And the answers to that are as varied as there are people sitting here or as there are people on the earth. The responses and the way to think about this and to think about it as Solomon would think about it is to despair and hope all at the same time and in the same breath. But here are some things Solomon wants us to understand in the verses that flow from the first 8 of chapter 3. The first thing he wants us to recognize is that though it often appears so, time is not pointless or purposeless. And all the ebb and flow of time, as we noted already, is weaving a tapestry, as it were. And we see the underside with all the scraggly strings and the unnoticeable and unrecognizable patterns developing underneath. And they don't seem to be related to us. But from heaven's perspective, he is making everything beautiful and has made everything beautiful in its time. Only God can do that. So that's an encouragement to us because there is not a thing in the way of experience and the ebb and flow of time and its seasonality, nothing, no thread of the tapestry is insignificant or lost. That's a good thing to remember because there seems to be in our life things full of pointlessness and insignificance, right? We struggle in pain and suffering and those kinds of things. We struggle to make sense of it. And it just seems to be a waste for us. It seems to have no purpose at all except to cause pain and misery and suffering. It's as if though God is upholding the carrot in front of us and never allowing us to partake. It is as though somehow he has some pleasure in inflicting pain. The conclusion of Solomon is that in places here. Under the sun, it appears to be that. But Solomon will rush in the latter parts of chapter 3 to assure us and to encourage us and to exhort us and perhaps to rebuke us in our sense of pointlessness and purposelessness. Heaven does not operate that way, and there is not a moment in time that is lost or meaningless. So that's one way to keep that in focus, because often, well, let's just say all the time, Solomon would say to us, God has put eternity in our hearts, but not a one of us has the ability to figure the beginning and the end. We just don't have what it takes. We are finite, living in the finite slice of time, in our epistemology, in our interpretation of how things happen and why they happen. We are limited and fallen, right, in every way. And when we are our most certain of our interpretation of things, we still are flawed. And we still lack a huge swath of data and information, not to mention the ability to put that stuff together, right? You with me on that? I mean, this permeates everything about us, even as moderns, even in the world of hard science and experimentation and falsifiability and all the kinds of things that seem to be so absolutely certain and definite. Even there, the best of scientists operate on the smallest bits of information, looking at the grand scheme of things, right? You know, the historians that write books? What historian could ever claim to have a comprehensive understanding of the flow of human history to be able to make some of the pronouncements that we make about history? There's no man, no group of men, no whole society of men that is up to that task, right? That's the truth. And that's why Solomon says, God puts this in the heart, a sense, an impulse, a recognition, but there is no ability for any man or group of men to string it all together and make sense of it all. It's a beautiful thing and a perplexing thing all at once to have eternity put in the heart, to know that when you bury somebody and when you watch animals and creatures die and when you watch the earth die and renew itself, it is a wonderful thing to know that that corresponds with a truth that comes from heaven itself and has been placed in us. Conscience, among other things. But it is perplexing that we just can't figure it out. And we are doomed to repeat the same things over and over, and we'll look at a place where that's actually so. The last part of chapter 4, we read something about that. Only God understands the beginning from the end. Only He can make sense of it. And only He can take what looks to be a loss to us and weave it into the tapestry of heaven's purpose and ordination. And grasping this truth will do a few things. It will create within us a desire and a capacity for something that we desperately need and often think poorly of. You know what that is? It will create in us both a desire and a capacity for long suffering, for humility, and for grace, all of which all of us are continually in need of. Right? You know, the fruit of the Spirit, love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, gentleness, faithfulness, self-control, something like that. When we are dead and done with this life and move into the age to come, the accusation will never be able to be made against us that we had too much of those things. Right? When I die, nobody will ever say about me, you know, he loved too much. It's wasted love. He loved too much. He had too much joy. Just killed him. Joy killed him. Or he was too kind of a person, too understanding of a person. He suffered too long. It will never, ever be able to be said of any of us. In fact, the exact opposite will be always true of us. We'll always come up short because we always fall short of what? The glory of God. The new covenant's restoring that and promises a continual and a full and a complete restoration of that in time. But right now, we're still limping along and we're still falling short of that. The capacity and the desire over time for, we could just narrow it to one thing, humility. The appropriate, beautiful expression of a creature before its creator, knowing its place and knowing its own ignorance and knowing its inabilities and its limitations, knowing its fallenness, knowing its recalcitrance with regard to righteousness and its all too easy movement towards wickedness, creates within the person a desire and an ongoing capacity for true humility. That's what we need. We are such a proud people, and we live in a time today that encourages us, without ever thinking about it, to be proud and haughty and boastful, to be impatient and the exact opposite of the kind of long-suffering that God develops in our hearts through a recognition of the things that Solomon is unfolding for us. And it is absolutely necessary. You cannot, and I cannot, live with joy as creatures before our Creator. We cannot live with joy before our Creator without long-suffering, humility, and grace. It cannot be done. So we desperately need those things. And that is an appropriate response and a desire and a prayer to God as we recognize our place in the heaven-ordained rhythm, ebb, and flow of the seasons and the times of our lives. It's how we should respond. Thirdly, the God-ordained structure and unfolding of time is designed to promote something very specific in our lives besides what I just talked to, and Solomon tells us about it in no uncertain terms in, in verse 14. The structure of time, the way God designed to do it this way and not that way, to begin and to have an end, and to place us within the confines of beginnings and ends all through our life, is a very specific design, and it is, in the way that it unfolds, is very specific design of an architect who is constantly bringing men to a point of fear before him. He does it to promote fear, verse 14 says. God does it that men should fear before him. And we know that the fear of the Lord is what? A little louder. Perfect. It's perfect. That's from Psalm, what, 19? Yeah. Yeah. And from Proverbs, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and also another place, the beginning of knowledge. So true knowledge and true wisdom, and wisdom in the Hebrew sense, is, to put it in a modern colloquialism, it is living a truly good life. That's what wisdom is. The knowledge and the employment of knowledge to live a truly good life, in contrast to Hollywood or whatever else we're looking at that's telling us the good life. Wisdom, biblical wisdom, sets our minds and our frames and our aims and our intentions and our desires and our responses to life in the context of the wisdom that the Bible gives and the way that we should live. But God has set all this up so that we would fear Him. And if there's anything in the created order, I love this. If you read back through the Old Testament, and this is a measure of how naturalist, how much of naturalists we've become in the way that we look at the created order. If you pay attention to the Bible, almost everything in creation, God chooses and names so that the invisible God might be known by the things that He has made, right? Right?
Right.
All right, I didn't see any movement at all there, and I guess maybe you're resisting me on this point. So you'll have to go back to your Bible and prove this for yourself. But when thunder comes, God doesn't want us to think about particles in the sky that are this temperature and that are moving this direction, running into other particles that are this temperature moving in that direction, or this rubbing against whatever in the sky. That's not the way He wants us to think about it. It's nice to know. It's fascinating what we can discover by our reason and our technology. Is fascinating. But what God wants us to think, that's My voice. And when the ground shakes because of thunder, God has given us an analogy of the nature of His voice. When water moves, like it did in Japan, and I don't want to make any capital, and I don't want to use this for theological purposes or to make some point besides the point the Bible makes. And the Bible talks about the irresistibility of the flood and its ability to completely sweep away whatever is in its way. And the first time I saw those pictures of that tsunami from that helicopter, it took me a minute or two to grasp what I was seeing from the height that I was seeing, because it almost looked like, you know, a wave washing up on the sand. You know how it creates the front and then recedes, you know? And from that height, I was looking and I thought, what am I looking at here? And then it dawned on me, I was looking at total destruction. I was looking at houses and boats and planes, and the biggest thing that was in the way of this water lifted up and taken away. It's a tragedy, and I don't want to capitalize on a tragedy, but God wants us to understand something about His power, about His irresistibility in the movement of water. And we can think of earthquakes, and we can think of all the things that are around, that are in and part of the created order. And the Bible always wants us to understand something about God. Lightning and thunder and water and trees and rocks and soil and seeds and rain and sun and darkness, all of it. They're all character qualities and descriptions of the God with whom we have to do. That's the way that God wants us to look at those things and to understand those kinds of things. And if we do, it will give rise, together with all the things that happen in time and in the created order, it will give rise to an appropriate fear. And anybody who hears a clap of thunder that seems to be about 10 feet off the right ear, you ever had those happen? Somebody who says, "I have to scare me, I like that," is a fool. At least in my book. Maybe they have an incapacity for fear or something, I don't know, which is a bad place to be in life. Because there are some things that need to be feared. And at the top of that list is the One who made everything. He's to be feared. So God ordains things that way. He is the architect of time. And time is one of those things that we can't control, and worse, we can't stop, right? You're a week older than when I last saw you, or 2 weeks older than when I last saw you. And it is inexorable. And when you're young, it seems less inexorable. It seems as though you can be suspended in time. You know, I've mentioned to you before, and you probably all know this, when I was in elementary school or younger, and we used to get off the summer for school. Of course, I think they've shortened it now. It seems like up in New York, or in Connecticut, my sister says they get off late June. They get out of school, and then they go back like early August or mid-August or something. They're changing the whole school year. But when we used to get off way back there in the days of Noah, summer was like a full 3 months or more. And it was like another whole year went by in the summer, you know. You were off from school that long. And it just seemed like it just lasted forever and ever and ever. And now it seems like, well, June's going to be over in no time. And then August will be here, and then we'll be into September, and blah, 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 and off it goes. So time seems to be compressed, but it doesn't slow down. It seems to slow down, but it doesn't slow down. It's moving along at the same tick that it has been moving along since I was born. At least I think it has. And it will continue on. And I'm going to be caught up in the net of the circumstance of time. I am caught in the unfolding of time. I don't have any choice in the matter of the seasonality of all the purposes under heaven. The only thing I can do is respond to them and believe certain things about my place in time and the one who rules over time. But it is meant to engender fear in us, and fear is a good thing. And then last, and though God is the architect and the dispatcher of time, He makes it very clear in verse 16 and 17 of chapter 3 that man is a creature, as a creature, is tasked to live in time, as if we had any choice, before the Creator. And our fundamental task in this web of time is to be doers of good and enjoyers of His good. And this comes out all over in Ecclesiastes and other places, but he says, for instance, in verse 12 of 3, chapter 3, I know that nothing is better for them than to rejoice and to do good in their lives, and that's a huge phrase. The Bible is consumed with the idea of goodness and righteousness. The commandments of God are connected to goodness and righteousness. The two great commandments are connected to good and righteousness. In Romans chapter 2, we are told men are going to be called to account for what they did in the body, whether what? Good or evil, good or bad. We don't like that verse because it sounds like works righteousness to us. But we don't understand the Bible and the flow of the movement if that's all we think about that passage. All men are going to be called to account, believers and unbelievers, on the basis of the things that we did in life. There is going to be an account. And one of the big tasks for we who live in the web of time and the unfolding of time, we who in particular recognize God as the architect of time and the one who moves it in the direction that He desires, is to be faithful in doing good and enjoying all the good that comes from God's hand. It is a gift of His. It is a gift to do good. It is a gift to enjoy good, because He says in verse 17, everyone will be judged, both the righteous and the wicked. So those are four ways that I think Solomon, and we'll learn others as we move along, Solomon would ask us to think about and respond to this ebb and flow of time. So he's laid all that before us. He has encouraged us and exhorted us and reminded us, in the midst of his looking at life under the sun, that there is more to life than just life under the sun. There is life under heaven, and it includes the God who orchestrates everything and will one day settle up accounts with all of the creatures that he has created. Now, let's move on to verse 18, where Solomon says, I said in my heart concerning the conditions of the sons of men, God tests them, and that word tests has the idea of exposing or revealing. God is exposing some things to men. Now, I ask you to mull about this idea. What is the condition of the sons of men? Given the condition of sons of men as he's describing here, how does that connect to God testing us and testing the sons of men? Anybody have any ideas on that? It's kind of a weird question to ask, and one I haven't really given you much time to think about. And I would always encourage you, when a question like this is asked or a statement like this is made, to try and find an answer in the context in which it's being given to us, whether it's the treatise or the verse or the passage here. And I think Solomon is doing that in particular. So if you'll let me, since we're short on time, I'm going to answer my own question, okay? What is the condition of the sons of men? And it is essentially this, and what he's described to us so far is that we are finite creatures, and that's an oxymoron, I suppose, in some ways, or a redundancy maybe. To be a creature is to be finite. We are stuck without choice of our own in this uncontrollable, unforeseeable, irresistible rhythm of time, with eternity placed in our hearts, stuck in time, seeing beginnings and ends, but with an idea that there is something more than the beginning and the end. And we have this imparted, inherent sense of justice and goodness, right? And though the Bible says that there is no one who is good or who does good in the New Testament, it is still nevertheless true, and the basis for our judgment, that we have conscience. And conscience is a word that means shared knowledge in its most basic form. And the shared knowledge we have is the knowledge of righteousness and goodness and evil, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. We share that with heaven. There is a conscience which is a meter or a gauge or an instrument or a faculty or a facility inherent in all men that bears witness with heaven's pronouncement of righteousness and what heaven says is right and good. And the conscience, we're told in Romans chapter 2, operates this way. It condemns unrighteousness and it affirms righteousness. Even without the law, Paul says, the Gentiles who don't have a law are a law unto themselves in the sense that the conscience in them, the shared knowledge between creator and creature, testifies and convicts us when we are wrong and convicts us and affirms us, I should say, when we are right. That is that imparted sense of justice and goodness, even if we deny God. Even if we deny theology and a theistic worldview, even if we are thoroughgoing materialists, it exists, it is there. And given that condition and the reality of judgment, Solomon asks the question from the perspective of strictly under heaven. Why should we care about any of that? How are we any different if all there is this world and life under the sun? How are we any different than the animals? That is the poke in the eye that Solomon is given to everybody who assumes only life under the sun, as he is doing himself. If life only exists under the sun and doesn't include the things that he has just tipped his hand to in the middle of chapter 3, how is it that we can differentiate man from the animals? How is it that we can think so little of babies and so highly of whales? How can the mind do that if we deny a theistic interpretation of the world, if we deny any responsibility, if we deny any firm and fixed standard of what might be right and what might be wrong, if we deny inherent value, if we deny created transposition of heavenly value upon earthly creation, if we deny those sorts of things, by what right as an example, do we have to value anything above man or man himself? Well, it's a natural conclusion. Solomon says it's an actual test of God. What happens to the sons of men from our pure observational standpoint is the same thing that happens to my cat and the bird and the bug and the earthworm. It all just goes back into the ground. And we never have another conversation with what goes into the ground and dissolves and decays and turns back to dust. So what's the basis of having any differentiation? Verse 21, he says, who knows whether the spirit of man goes up and the spirit of the animal goes down into the ground? Who knows that? Who can tell you that? Observation doesn't tell us that. Our pure reasoning faculties are not going to lead us to that conclusion, though we have whispers of it in us from that eternity placed in the heart thing. Creation whispers that to us and echoes the idea of resurrection. We've talked about that several weeks ago. It is no accident that God has embedded death and resurrection in everything around us. The whole created world begins and ends, stumbles and starts over and over and over again. And it is not an accident of nature. It is not a random direction that nature is developing to preserve itself. It is a design of the God who raised his son from the dead. We have no reason, Solomon would say, to think any more highly of men than we would think of animals if all we have is life under the sun. Who can bring him to see what will happen after him, he says in verse 22. So from that perspective, there's nothing better than a man should rejoice in his own works. What a man can do in this life, what a man can produce, what he can enjoy. He's picked this theme up before, and he tells us in previous instances that this is a gift of God, but looked strictly from the point of view of the naturalist or the materialist, really the best a person could hope for is to find some enjoyment in this life. You probably have heard it said, and I don't remember who said this, the only heaven an unbeliever will ever know is in this life, and the only hell a believer will know is in this life. I think I said that right, and I probably didn't say it as eloquently as the person who thought it up. And it's probably not absolutely true, but there's a lot of truth to it. And Solomon is telling us if this is all we have to hope for, and there's really no difference between us and an animal, then I guess we just need to kind of turn internally and focus on finding joy ourselves in whatever we can find to do. And the implications of that are quite scary, actually. And he picks up that thread in verse 1 and the first three verses of chapter 4 as he begins to consider the whole issue of oppression. And it is the larger question of evil, the presence of evil. And atheists will chide theists for not having what appears to be good answers to this. How do you account for a God who really is good, allowing these kinds of things to exist in a world when he has the ability or the power to stop it, when it is inconsistent with his own character? It's a vexing question, but it is no less vexing for the atheist. Why should evil exist at all? Why should we even call evil evil? If we're all animals, and we all die like animals, we could act like animals, and we should suffer no repercussions for it. And so if you have something that I want, or if I don't like you, or survival of the fittest, whatever the case may be, go for it. You go for it, because there is no difference. And oppression and other things like that exist, which to some might be an evidence that there is no God, in fact. Solomon doesn't have a super comfortable answer here for us. We have to back up to chapter 3 and know that God has the ability to make everything beautiful and will. I don't know how he's going to do that. I cannot conceive My imagination just doesn't go that far. But I know he is able to do exceedingly above and beyond what I think or imagine. I do know that. And I do believe what I know about God in the Bible is that he is thoroughly and purely and absolutely and 100% good. He is good, the psalmist wrote, and he does good. He's incapable of mistakes, and he is incapable of cruelty and sin and evil. How that meshes with what we observe of life under the sun, I don't have the best answer for. And Solomon didn't either. So his conclusion was, it'd be better not to be born. And the people who have already died are better off than the people who are already living. And this is a natural conclusion if you take the atheistic perspective. If there's no room for theism and the existence of God in your worldview, then you have to follow it to its conclusions. And the conclusions are despair and death and destruction. The conclusions are amoral and immoral. The problem is that people who follow that conclusion through often don't like the results of following that through because it leaves them on the sharp end of the stick. And Solomon saw that. If it's the case that there is no God and it's only life under the sun, take the case of oppression and the people who exercise power and those who have nobody to deliver them from their oppressors, and they have no comforter. And there are many, many people in the world like this today. In fact, I have a little side thing, and I think I'll probably pick this up in the days to come when we get a little further down in Ecclesiastes. But I would ask you to consider something. What does it mean to be a person of power? What is power? What power do you have? And how do you use your power? And does your use of, do you recognize what power is put into your hands? And do you recognize and follow through with your responsibility to the power that you have been granted? This is a question I don't think I've ever asked myself until recent months and years. And you may think of yourself as a not powerful person, but you probably would be surprised, and you might even be surprised to know that power that has put in your hand might be liable with those who are being oppressed. Now, you and I might be complicit in the exercise of oppressive power. It's a question that we don't raise as often as we should, and Solomon just throws it out. He doesn't really deal with it here except to note and to observe that there are those with power and who exercise that power absolutely to the oppression of others. The prophets in Israel's history were incensed by this in Israel's national life. They said this frequently. The wages of those that you are withholding, or the voices of those you are withholding wages from, cry out to God. And God said, I will avenge. The way that Israel began to treat the widow and the fatherless and the downtrodden and the marginalized in their society invited God's judgment, and in time ended in God's judgment because they exercised power in an unrighteous and ungodly way, in particular the leaders of Israel. But we'll leave off of that. We'll revisit that question in the days to come here. We just note in verse 2 and 3 these horrible, weighty laments where Solomon says, if this is the case, it would be better than the one who has lived and died, or the one who is living and still alive, it'd be better than both of them if someone had never existed and never had to see the evil that is on the earth. And technology and news and cable and all that stuff brings the immediacy and the graphic nature of evil and oppression to us as close as our computer screens, and we can watch murder and mayhem and oppression and suffering and starving and injustice on a grand scale today. And the sad thing is that probably most of us are unmoved by it. And more than being unmoved, we don't even understand our place in it. We haven't thought about it because we don't think that the Bible really addresses that. We'll come back to that in the days that lie ahead. But let's move on in just a couple of places here. There are really four things that Solomon does here in chapter 4. Hey, I didn't recognize that. Four things in chapter 4. Woohoo! I'm all proud of myself. You'll remember chapter 4 now. You won't remember the four things, but you'll say, I know there are four things in chapter 4 that Solomon's talking about. The first thing has to do with oppression. All four of these things really harken back to... they have to do with the Ten Commandments and the two great commandments and everything the Bible ever said in the Old Covenant about law. You know, and I'm not going to give you this big lesson here now because we've talked about this before, but you know, when it comes to the law of God, there's really only two laws. Ten Commandments are a teasing out of what those laws look like. The prophets and the historical books and even the Psalms are teasing out in particular ways and case studies and all that kind of thing of the disposition and the unfolding of these two great laws. What are the two great laws? What are the two great commandments? Yep. And those are not equal because the love for God is something different than love for neighbor, though the one derives from the other. Love of neighbor is preceded by love of God. And it is true that love of neighbor really can't take the kind of shape it does and have the kind of intent and motive that it should have if the love of God is not first in place. But when you stop to think about these ways that men are really differentiated from animals, he's kind of teasing this out in chapter 4 by four different scenarios he talks about. And the first one is this oppression that he talks about. Why is it that men oppress each other this way? Given what he has already said, it's a violation of the great commandment. It is the violation of the command to love your neighbor as yourself. It exists in this world under the sun where men deny the existence of God and see that this is the only life that there is. That's in the first three verses. In the next four verses, Solomon tells us something about selfishness and envy. Competitiveness. This is one of those sneaky things that can exist in our lives and be undiscovered. It can move us to desire and to achieve and to obtain. It can move us in a failure in our love of neighbor in ways that we don't understand. We don't think about it. We don't call it this. But Solomon says in verse 4, again, I saw that for all toil and every skillful work, a man is envied by his neighbor. I think the ESV translates that just a little bit differently by saying that all of our toil and all of our skillful work comes from envy of our neighbor. It's a little different nuance. It's a cause and effect sort of thing. And I think it's altogether possible that both of those are true. But isn't it true that we look around us? We examine life. We are products of our culture, of the Madison Avenue approach to life. We look around us. And we look at the wicked and we look at the righteous, and if they are prospering more than we are, don't we struggle with pangs of envy and jealousy? Don't we sometimes feel the sting of not having what somebody else has? Is there really a man on the earth who is truly content? It's a great question. It's a harder one for us to answer. Solomon says, I see a man who toils, he works hard, and he's skillful at what he does, and he's envied by his neighbor for it. Or his neighbor envies him, or he envies his neighbor. He says it's a vanity. It's a grasping for the wind. He goes on to say the fool folds his hands and consumes his own flesh. That could mean one of two things. A fool folding his hand is somebody who is stingy. It is somebody who closes his hands to the needs of the poor. Whether he means that here, I'm not exactly sure. The other idea, and Solomon may have been picking up this idea from what he wrote in Proverbs, the fool is the one who folds his hand and just lays off in apathy and inertia. And he's not a hard worker, and he doesn't supply for himself. Either way, the conclusion follows, you consume your own flesh. God says if you see the needs of those around you and you close up your spirit and close up your hands, God will close up his generosity to you. By the same token, if you're the kind of person who folds your hand, yawns, gets a little rest, brings a little bit more food, and sits back in your easy chair and doesn't know the idea of working not only to supply for yourself but for others, what you're actually doing is consuming yourself. And one day you will find want come on you like an armed bandit, Solomon would say in Proverbs. Whatever his meaning there, he kind of concludes in verse 6 by saying it's a whole lot better to have a handful with quietness. You know this, don't you? I know we know this, but boy, do we struggle to believe it. Because if I can get two handfuls, I'm going for it. If I can get four handfuls, I think I need it. And it's just hard for me to wrap my mind around the reality that a handful with quietness is better than both hands full with constant toil and grasping for more. You got to drop what you got to go for more, I guess. We should learn this lesson early and always. Solomon's going to say a little bit later, guess I should stop there. We'll pick up next week, I think. Well, next week's the Lord's table, I think, so we do a little bit of a different thing then. So the week following, we're going to pick up this beautiful section about companionship and friendship and the beauty of the gifts